Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Content Sutra podcast. Joe Lazauskas, editor-in-chief at Contently, back again with my co-host Shane Snow.
What's up, everybody?
Co-founder of Contently and best-selling author. And here we have another incredibly popular and prolific author, James Altucher, who also has run a hedge fund, has been a serial entrepreneur and venture capitalist, and is now becoming one of the most interesting bloggers and individual media brands in the industry. And that's what we're here to talk about today, is the future of the individual as a media brand. And to start off, James, you know, that was a quick introduction, but I found that so much more interesting from your own words, your own life. Your blog is incredibly personal and riveting, and millions of people love it. Can you tell us about how you got to where you are today and what you're doing right now?
Sure. So first off, thanks you guys for having me on the podcast. So basically, about 20 years ago, I was in a similar business to the business you guys are in right now. It's almost like prehistoric times when companies didn't have websites yet, and I was building their first website. So I built websites for Time Warner, American Express. I did the first Miramax.com, NewLineFilms.com, October. All these film companies that don't even exist anymore. Did all these music label websites. And obviously, looking at me, you could tell what kind of music. It was all gangster rap. So I was really helping them build their brands and not even thinking about, you know, there was no such thing as the individual brand. Like, people had their own personal websites, but there wasn't it was very hard then to build a website, which is why you could charge a lot of money to build websites. But that business sort of, that industry sort of disappeared because it's so easy now to build websites. And it transformed really into what you guys are doing, which is, given that you have a website and you have a basic internet strategy, how can you take it to the next level? And I think a lot of companies struggle with, you know, do you build a brand? Do you build individual brands and so on? But skipping ahead many years, and I'm skipping ahead kind of the most horrific years of my life, but just real briefly, like, I sold a company and then I didn't know what to do. So I was like a drunken rock star on steroids. I like lost all this money, went broke. No, I didn't do steroids, but I was like a drunken rock star without any talent. But maybe that's how most drunken rock stars are. I can't even believe all the things I did to lose money. But the important part was I totally like bombed and failed at everything I did, like everything. And I had to figure out, like, when you're in the middle of it, like right now I feel like out there, and particularly in like Silicon Valley, there's this thing I call failure porn, where you're like, oh yeah, I failed, so now I should be a successful entrepreneur after that. And failing is not like that. Like, it really just feels bad. Like, when you're in the gutter, like, you're actually in the gutter, and that it feels like really bad. And how do you get up from that to have better success than before? You should, because you're more mature and you know more. But at the moment, when you're actually like face down, it doesn't feel that way. So I had to figure out, I had two kids, I had to figure out again and again and again, to the point where I would be like, why is this happening to me again, where I'm like on the gutter? And, you know, gradually I figured out what was going right on the way up and what was I doing wrong on the way down. And so I decided to start blogging about this, and not from the point of view, like, you see all these articles in magazines, like, here's 10 ways to have more confidence, or here's 10 power poses to dominate a room, or whatever. And it's all like these lectures. And I'm like, you know, what's your story? Where, in order for you to have done so much work and figure this stuff out, you must have reached a point where you were feeling so bad and horrible when you walked into a room that you came up with these weird power poses, like, you know, hold your arms like this for 10 minutes in a mirror. And I want to know the story behind these tips or rules, so that I can figure out for myself whether it's worth trying. And so that's the point of view where I started. I started saying my story, and people who I knew were completely shocked. They were like, people would tweet, this is like watching a train wreck in real time. Like, James is either gonna kill himself or totally blow up in the industry, you know, completely ruin his reputation or whatever. And I did ruin my reputation for all of those people who knew me before, but gradually people really resonated with this story or these stories that I had. And it really helped people, as opposed to just writing an article with, you know, here's 10, you know, stocks you could buy, or 10 ways to be a leader, which helps a small number of people. Telling your story that people really resonate with and connect with at the heart level instead of the brain level, that actually says to people, okay, this guy has experienced something that I'm going through now to some extent, and maybe I'm going to continue to read him. And because I might learn something, or I might be entertained, or he's just weird and maybe he really will kill himself, so I'll read it anyway. And so you give people many reasons to read you or follow you, and you know, some of them are good reasons, some of them are kind of entertaining reasons, some of them are bad reasons, and gradually you build up an audience. And
this gets at something that we talk about all the time at Contently, which is that great stories make people care.
Right.
And they build relationships, and that, I guess, that's what, you know, branding is all about, is building relationships and making people care about something. People don't care about the generic sort of advice, lecture, whatever, but they do care about a person that they're starting to get to know, and that, especially, you know, the personal story element of it, like, people become invested even in, I mean, that's when I discovered your writing. I was really invested in what's going to happen to this guy, and, you know, is this, because it's very, very vulnerable.
Yeah, and I think the challenge is, of course, and not to be so obvious about mutually complimenting, but the challenge, of course, is, you know, there's only so many stories about your life you could tell, and then you have to figure out ways to tell other stories, but with your filter on it. And I think you do that very well in Smart Cuts, for instance. So, because that's all story-driven. You go from story to story to story, but it shows, at the end of the day, the Smart Cuts that... I just said quote sign. The Smart Cuts that people use to kind of get ahead in life. And so there's a couple of different ways to kind of approach the storytelling thing. You could either tell your own personal stories, or you could tell what you learned from other people's stories and have a kind of unique slant on it. But so I mix it up with both so I don't run out of material. But so, and you know, you've probably, what's the famous study where this guy took a bunch of trinkets he bought in China and put it on eBay, and he didn't have any story, and he just, to see where the auction, you know, eBay is an auction site, so to see what people were willing to pay for each object. Then he took the same trinkets and put these elaborate stories underneath each one, like this was owned by a pirate and blah blah blah, and then the prices went way up, like skyrocketed 300%. So storytelling in general, and this is almost an evolutionary thing, stories for 10,000 years is how humans went from tribes to, you know, world-spanning societies. No other species does that, because we, you know, and part of that's driven, again, from storytelling. Like before we had storytelling, we had tribes. After we had storytelling, whether it was, you know, religion, like Jesus, you believe in Jesus, or whether it's an empire, like you believe that the United States is the greatest country, or, you know, that's all a story. No, none of it is, you know... Yeah, make it very pretty. That's if you think about it, that's the story they use to kind of motivate 300 million people. And without storytelling, you wouldn't be able to motivate anybody. So that's how we've been able to create kind of this global society now.
What's really impressive to me with you, as someone who's written a lot of, you know, creative confessional nonfiction, is you do it and you're like, okay, this is never going to make me any money, but it's something that I really enjoy. And yet you've managed to build an entire really robust media business off of that.
Yeah, and so for 5 years I was just writing stories and publishing books and so on. And then I decided, okay, let's apply my own ideas and build a business. I always am looking for new experiences to do, so I wanted to build a business. Also, I wanted to hire people to help me, you know, distribute my content, to do research, and so on. And, you know, I think I was talking to Naveen Jain, who started InfoSpace, and now he has this company where he's going to mine for rare earth minerals on the moon, and then he's going to use that as kind of a, ultimately his goal is to colonize Mars. So billionaires have great, great big dreams and fantasies. And I said, why don't you just, you're a billionaire, why don't you just send a rocket, you know, build a rocket to Mars and throw $1 billion at it. And he said, you know, I could do that, but that's not sustainable. So a good idea is sustainable. So he built it. So even though the guy's got billions of dollars, he still wanted to build a business that, I'm not saying I have $1 billion, he had $1 billion, and he wanted to build a business that was sustainable. So I figured, okay, I want to hire people, but I want to have their efforts be sustainable and have a business around it so that that could keep going. And so I decided, okay, I'm going to still give everything away for free that I always do, which is, you know, I usually do an article a day or an article every other day, and then I do a bunch of podcasts. And so that's all going to remain free. And then I'm going to do an extra newsletter, basically almost like a super blog post. Like instead of it being, let's say, 1,000 words, it might be 5,000 words and have a lot of researched content in it. And then I also wanted to do a financial newsletter on top of that because people are so out of touch with what financial reality is that I felt like education was needed. And so that business, and so it's all has the best intents. I've got really good people.
And so you charge for that?
I charge for that, yeah. Even though everything I was doing before for free, I still do for free. So there's nothing anybody's missing, but just now I do extra. And so if people want extra, they pay. And it's not so much. It's like my basic newsletter is 40, depending on what, you know, it's about $80 a year, but I think the starting package is $40 a year. And the reason I don't really know is because I'm not good at that. At business, that's how I lose all my money. So I hired like a CEO in Denver, like really far away from me, and he hired everyone else and built a business around that. So I have no clue what's going on a daily basis. Like literally they have a meeting, how can we do this, this, and this? And I have no idea what's going on in my own business, which made it work great because it built up to, you know, millions in profit. And just, we started it this year, millions in profits, you know, eight figures in revenues, and it's just been a great first year of business.
I mean, that's crazy to make, you know, millions of dollars in your first year for any content.
Yeah, started March 1st. So it's been like 9 months. It's been amazing.
So like how did, you know, your team go about building up the subscribers that it takes at, you know, $80 a person, or, you know, I know it's more for your financial newsletter. How do you get just the subscribers to one, opt in to pay for it? Because you always hear that people don't want to pay for content. And then two, like just scale that so quickly.
Well, you know, for the first part, it's not so much a strategy, it's more almost like an ego thing. Like I really wanted people to read my stories. And Shane and I have discussed this in the past, actually. What do? You go, and also I had this discussion with Ev Williams, the founder of Twitter, Medium, Blogger. Do you build like a personal website, or, and you try to make your personal website a destination for people, or do you put your content on actual destination sites? So for instance, the Huffington Post is a destination site. People wake up in the morning and they say, okay, I'm gonna consume content on the Huffington Post or on Medium or on LinkedIn or on, you know, Thought Catalog or any of these other websites. So the first thing I would do is I did have a destination website, which was jamesaltucher.com, but I also put content on maybe 20 other websites almost every day or every other day. And within that content, I would have links back to my website. It was never a destination website. Nobody would ever wake up and say, okay, what's the latest on jamesaltucher.com? But it was always like, if you want to read more about this topic, go to this post, and then that would go to my site. And then on my site, if you want to read more, sign up for an email newsletter. So the email newsletter is very critical because then you have a direct audience that you're communicating with. So it becomes, so it's both push and pull. So the pull is when you post content everywhere, the pull strategy, call it, and people see it and then they can maybe get pulled to your website and pulled to your email list and so on. Push is when you write brand new content, you send it out to however big your email list is. My email list started small, but then over time got bigger, and that's all free. But sometimes I would run contests and give away books and so on to build up my email list. And then from that, that's the first group you can market to. You have people who have already raised their hand and said, oh, I would like to read more by this person. And then I can, you know, 5 years later, I was able to say, okay, well, now I have something that I'm really putting an extra, almost inhumane amount of effort in. And if you want to see that also, you can pay $40 the first year, $80 the second year, and so on. And you get a free book as well, and free other stuff. Like we gave away a lot of free things. And, you know, and that built up a nice, kind of what's called front end business. That's when the real front end is the free stuff. Kind of the middle end is where they've signed up to say, yes, we like your content so much, we'd be willing to pay a small amount for it. And then, you know, marketing to that group, and not over marketing. You don't want to be like an asshole about it. Can I use words like that on the planet? so you don't want to be like a jerk. But if I had content I believed in, I would say, look, you can also get this too. Like, here's this financial newsletter. And you know, a lot of people will come to you and they realize you have a big list and say, hey, can you also mention my thing? And 99.999% of the time I say no, because everybody's got some scam out there that they want to promote and make a little bit of money on, like, $50 for Jesus's diet, or, you know, to lose all your weight. And, or here's, you know, some, for, you know, currency trading system, you're going to triple your money every year. So that's like the typical information product out there. And I want to say it's even like 100% evil. So I don't like any of that. But,
well, so it's your, like, what your equity is essentially that trust that people have that you're going to send them stuff that they actually are going to like.
Right. And the problem is a little bit, even when you market your own stuff, and we talked about this a little before the podcast, when does it cross the line where you're quote unquote selling out? And I don't really know the answer to that. Like, I was really terrified to sell anything because I didn't want people to think, you know, to sell anything, you have to use some kind of marketing language. And that wasn't my style. So I had to hire people to help me market my own things. And it felt to me like selling out. And you always have that vocal minority that hates anything you do differently. And so they would reach out to me and say, I hate you now. And like, literally, they would say that. And it felt so bad. I mean, a lot of people would sign up, and so I would never hear from them. I just, because it was fine. I didn't need to.
It's like internet commenters. You don't hear the people that are like, great job, I like the article. You hear them say, like, there's a typo.
Right, but these people get so angry, they would write whole articles on their blogs, like James Altucher, like, just, that's the, you know, he jumped the shark or whatever.
That's when you made it, man, when people start writing mean articles on their blogs about you. Like,
oh my God, I made it a long time ago, man, because I get nonstop mean articles. So, I mean, some of these would get really depressing. And you know, I figured out a real secret for that, which is if someone writes an article about you or says anything bad about you, the natural inclination is to respond and list all the ways they're, and be really defensive and list all the ways they're wrong. You know, it's kind of like that cartoon, you know, honey, I can't go to sleep right now. There's someone wrong on the internet. Yeah. But I figured out if once you stop responding, and you really should never respond to anybody who's you know, over the top negative, but once you stop responding, it takes 24 hours for it to disappear. So if you keep responding, it's always that every time you respond to somebody, you have to start the clock again, and it takes another 24 hours. And so sometimes, though, like someone write an article and they would by accident hit the right buttons, and I'd start responding, and it'd be like a month later, like I'd come up for air, and I'm like, what did I just do? I feel like
you got a long beard, right? Like bleary eyed.
If I had just not responded like that first minute, it would have just been gone like 24 hours later. But like literally, people became like the top article on Medium simply because I was responding to them, and that was where the whole discussion, like the content, was in the comments as opposed to the article. And then everyone would be like, you're you know, this or that, and I'm like, no, I'm not, because of this. And it's just like too much responding.
Well, there's a couple of things there that I think are really interesting. One is that, you know, Joe pointed out that in this, you know, 9 month span, you know, you've grown to, you know, 8-figure revenue, 7-figure profit business. But it sort of illustrates the myth of the overnight success. So this is actually a business that's 5 years in the making.
5 years, and even before that, because I used to write for a lot of newspapers and go on CNBC a lot and Yahoo Finance a lot. I came from the finance area, but I also was a writer previously. And so I had kind of a finance audience. And so people, that was like the first reaction, like people who knew me from that world were like, what is he doing? Like all he's talking about is how much money he loses. You're supposed to say the opposite, like how much money you make and how you're always perfect in all your predictions. And I would talk about how I was always wrong. And people were like, what is happening here? So that kind of kickstarted that different style of reaction or audience. But I had built that audience maybe for the prior 8 years. So
there's years and years of potential energy, basically, that right. Once you allowed it to move, right, like it became kinetic, and that's what built the business.
Right, so people have to be willing to give themselves permission to fail a little bit when they start. Like, okay, you're going to start a blog, and there's 50 visitors, and there's 100 visitors, and you're going to try new things, and you're going to try to be vulnerable, and try to post more and more about, you know, you kind of have to bleed a little bit so it becomes uniquely your story and is very vulnerable and it connects with others. And then I just want to add on the business side, this is a little, I'm just slightly off topic, but just to add, it wasn't just me marketing to my own audience. I had a network of maybe 85 other companies that helped me market. So I hired someone to run all the affiliates, and he would call up people with other lists, you know, and other media organizations and make deals with them. Hey, can you market James's newsletter about X? And then they would, and we would provide all the marketing copy, and they would run campaigns to their audience, and we would do a huge split with them where they really benefited huge on the first year, and then I get the renewals. So this is a little bit more kind of, what do you call it, like inside talk about how these businesses work. But having 85 affiliates, I mean, I was my best affiliate, but they were all, some people really made a lot of money selling my product. So that's how that business sort of works. That's how I got to tens of millions of people. I was able to outreach to them as opposed to just my list.
Yeah, the other point that I was going to say is that there's this expectation. So as bloggers, journalists, writers, authors become their own brands and their own business, there's this expectation that they also now need to have the skills, every skill required to in every position of a business, right? You need to be a marketer, you need to be a salesperson, you need to be able to do operations and accounting and all of those things. And I think what you've done successfully this time with this business is you've basically gotten other people who are specialists at those things to do that work so that you can focus on the thing that really makes your brand unique.
Right. That's very important because, you know, I know one of my, I don't want to say key to success because I don't necessarily, you know, you're always on some place on the ladder of success. But one of the things I learned really quickly is that I'm not the smartest person in the room. So you always have to find the smartest person. If you want to really succeed, you have to find the smartest person in the room to stand next to and just say, oh, okay, I'm going to do what this person is doing, or use or pay him to do this one activity better. So I'm not very good at like marketing or direct sales. I'm not very good at investing. So how can I do like, let's say, a financial newsletter? But what my strategy for many years has always been to invest with people a lot smarter than me. So that's on the investing side. But so that makes me a better investor. Almost people look and say, oh, he's a good investor. But I've never my worst investments are the ones that I found for myself. And then I would invest in, and it would go to zero. My best investments were like, okay, Peter Thiel is also investing in this. Now I'm just going to quietly like piggyback right behind him, and then bam, it would be good. So I think, yeah, I knew from my own experience, I'm not the best guy to run a business or make decisions for a business or deal with HR and employees. So hire someone who is really good at that or has a proven track record at that. Not everyone can hire someone to do that. I was fortunate because I had built up, but that's the part of building up. That's why it takes years. So
how would you go about it if, you know, you're a journalist without a lot of upfront money to start doing this, but you have a popular column on like a pretty well-read site and a strong following and a distinct voice? What are like the baby steps you take at first to get something like this going?
Sure. So I have two stories. One is, and this is an interesting thing because of when you're talking about individual media people, like let's say a journalist who's popular. So one time, a top executive at the Wall Street Journal, I never used to mention the paper because he was still there, but as a top executive at the Wall Street Journal, invited me to breakfast just to kind of exchange ideas. And he said, we're having a big problem. A lot of the reporters are asking for raises because they have, you know, so many Twitter followers and they're building a big following. And, you know, at the Wall Street Journal, we want to make sure there's no stars. You know, it's all about the paper. The paper is the brand. And I said, don't you want the individual reporters to, you know, for people to come back to the paper because their favorite journalists and columnists are there? And he's like, no, the Wall Street Journal is the brand. And also this way, we don't want them to have two big heads that they're going to ask for raises. And I don't mean to point out the Wall Street Journal, that guy has long left and he's a very good guy, but that's kind of the problem of, in general, of media companies versus, you know, individual brands. Like the media company wants to be the brand, not the individuals, because then the individuals go off and do something else. But the way to do something else is, you know, when I started blogging, let's even just say 6 years ago, I was like totally, or 5 years, I was pretty much broke at that time. Like this was like the fourth time I'd gone totally broke. And, you know, after making like significant money, and I just started writing without any anticipation at all. I had no money to like hire people or, you know, but what happens is people start to say, okay, this person is an honest voice. We want to get his advice about, and he's done a lot of things. And he has information about a lot of things and a network and so on. We want to get his advice about something. So I started to build up, making money. You know, people would pay for advice, or people would have me do speaking gigs. People eventually, I was only selling my book for 99 cents, you know, with my different books, but people, a lot of people would buy the books. And so gradually I built up, and then I would go on board seats and make money there, or I would get really good investment opportunities and make money there. And gradually you build up. So it takes time, but I built up enough doing, and this was, I didn't have any business, but you know, people think, oh, I have to start a business to make a lot of money. No, you can just do lots of multiple streams of income to make a lot of money, and some of them will work and some of them won't. And using that, I was then able to, essentially I got then, and I said, I got then an investor who was constantly pitching me, you should build a media business out of your own content. And then that's what kicked it off, you know, then being able to hire somebody and so on and build up a nice business.
So you might boil down, you know, for the columnist or someone who's a, you know, a blogger or working journalist that has some amount of popularity, kind of what you're saying is you took your expertise and your reputation and you found different ways to turn that into revenue. Yeah, and speaking is a classic example of that, right?
Maybe like six or seven different ways to build income off of me writing constantly how bad I was. So, but you know, another great example is look at Business Insider, which just recently sold for $340 million to Axel Springer. So that started with basically Henry Blodgett, who was kind of a, you know, he had been a, everybody, you know, blamed him practically. He became like the poster child of the dot-com bust. He was like shamed, all these things. But then he started blogging. Such a smart guy. People would go to his site and he started blogging about stocks. And he built up Business Insider out of that. And he got investors. But he got investors. This was like 6 or 7 years ago. He got investors. No, more than that. Like over 10 years ago, he got like his first investments. And he built and built and built. And you know, then sold for $340 million, one of the biggest deals of last year in the kind of online media business. So, yeah, you just build up over time.
And going back to the journal example, I feel like that's such an outdated way of thinking at this point that a lot of media brands latch onto, that it's not about the individual, it's about the brand, it's about the publisher. But really, I think we're moving to a world where publishers almost act as agents, or like, you know, the RE Golds of the world for different writers, where their role is to really provide them with different perks, because it isn't about the homepage anymore. It's about people coming sideways into content, which is usually so focused on who the writer is. So they have to give, you know, job benefits and good salary and ultimately a really good ability to reach people through social media and through email. But they're basically acting just as like these rocket ships for the individual writers to get in and reach as many people as possible and do as much as possible, as opposed to, you know, these giant, benevolent, you know, old school, you know, media brands that you're just happy to work for.
Yeah, no, I agree. It might be an, like, for instance, meeting I had with this executive took place many years ago. Within the past 4 years, but, or meeting took place 4 years ago. So everybody says, oh, I'm in the top four. Okay, you're fourth. So otherwise you would say you're first. But I agree. I think that people are changing their thinking in many ways about this, which is a good trend. But you have these open platforms like Medium and LinkedIn where people can break out too by, you know, again, don't try to drive people, don't write well and try to drive people to your to what you think is your destination site, because that's two activities that are both very difficult. Write well and go on a site that's already a destination site, like a LinkedIn or Medium, where it's a pretty open platform, and there are many actually, but those are like pretty big open platforms that people wake up and say, okay, I'm gonna consume content here. Then you can distribute your content on like Facebook or Twitter, you know, say, oh, I just wrote my first article on Medium or LinkedIn, here's the link. And then people can share it very easily. So focus on the destination sites first, as opposed to, let's say, big private, not as open sites, like let's say in a newspaper, you know, where it's really hard to get like a column for the New York Times, for instance. You know, Medium and LinkedIn, you can just post something every day. And then the ultimate goal is to drive people to a destination site or not. You really just want people to know who your name, what your name is. So destination site doesn't necessarily mean anything.
Well, how do you, like, what's the calculus for driving traffic to any of these sites? So, well, I guess personal example, I started blogging on LinkedIn early on, and because LinkedIn grew I grew a big audience because I was early. And like right. that happens, and that's kind of, you know, luck. Maybe there's a little bit of pattern recognition of like, here's a new platform I think is going to be good or whatever. But a lot of times that's luck. But once a platform's saturated, you kind of are on the hook for getting people to be aware of it, of your content at all.
Right. So you just mentioned two things there. So I'll just repeat them back into actionable items. One is identify a platform that's new where you can be among the first. So LinkedIn was great. I bet you when you first started writing articles, there was hundreds of thousands of views per article. Now it's a little bit harder. You have to, there's, you know, 200,000 people now writing for LinkedIn. So, which is great for all those people, but it's hard to maintain that level you're at. So then the second thing is just showing up, like being there every day and continuing to write good material and so on. You might not get as many views, but it'll just be consistent, and that's going to be your hardcore audience anyway. But then, you know, going back to number one, always try to identify new platforms, try them out. Some will work, some won't. But then there's a third item, which is a little bit more of a, not secret sauce, but, you know, make sure you use Facebook and Twitter. So often I will write, you know, similar articles on just in my status update on Facebook. And because then I know I'm going to get engagement from at least my friends and, you know, people who are interested in my stuff. And I'll often say, this is, you know, for more on this, check out LinkedIn, or maybe I won't, or maybe I'll drive people to a destination site. Maybe I won't drive people anywhere. I just want people to engage with my content because I love writing and I love engaging with people and so on. So just being as open as possible and trying as many platforms as possible. And then you could share on Twitter. I just wrote, you know, how to totally screw up 2016, and I put it on LinkedIn. Check it out. Put that on Twitter. So people are going to want to see how Shane Snow is going to screw up in 2016, and they'll click on it. You know, so title is really important, you know, for something like that, you know, for Twitter.
Yeah, I love that you just post full articles and status updates on Facebook. I think that's awesome. I actually did that a couple summers ago. Shane probably remembers when I got jumped in Israel and I had my jaw broken for the entire summer, which sucked. Like,
oh,
the worst thing is being like newly single, 25 years old in New York with a broken, you know, wired together jaw. So I started like a blog that was like Through the Wires, a daily chronicle of life with my jaw broken and like all the crazy stuff that happened with me in Israel, like having a, you know, a great like fling with a really hot Israeli defense officer and then like getting jumped and having to leave her. But the place that posted the best were actually on Facebook, when I just posted, you know, the text, the entire article on Facebook and get like reshared and like hundreds of likes. So
yeah, because Facebook is like built for engagement better than any other platform. Like, I almost wish Facebook would give you more publishing tools to like format and things like that. It's very limited, the publishing tools on Facebook. Like, you can't, like, it's sort of unclear how to best use multimedia, you know, in those posts and stuff. But I find Facebook to be actually the best platform to post on, because initially exactly the people you want to engage with your content will be the first engagers, and then if they share it, you know, then you get the second wave of engagers and so on, and people make comments and it's easier to respond to them because you get all these alerts about people posting on your Facebook page and so on. So I think that's a great place to build audience. And you know, that there's another great thing about posting on Facebook. Let's say you post something and it's not so good. A, your friends will forgive you for posting something not so good, but B, now you know, okay, nobody engaged with this. I'm not going to post this on LinkedIn or any place else because this is a good test. This wasn't so good. If you write every day, not everything you do is going to be good. You can't write 365 great articles a year, or 50, even 50 great articles a year. Write like 4 good articles a year. Some articles might be amusing, but you'll know from the engagement on Facebook, oh my gosh, this got 150 shares as opposed to 0 shares. You'll know from testing what's good enough to go to other platforms.
Yeah, you know those like 3 people on Facebook who like every update you ever put on no matter what, and if like they don't like it, you've really messed up.
Right, exactly. And that those 3 might change over time. Like, I've noticed that with my own stuff. Like, some people will kind of hop on the train for a while and then get off the train and then hop on later. But yeah, there's always like a consistent group who likes to consume your content, and then it's really interesting to see, you know, who beyond that engages with it. But again, I think Facebook is such a great platform for seeing engagement right away. My problem is it's like an addiction. If I don't get like two likes a minute in the first 30 minutes after I post something, I feel like, oh God, that was just, I didn't do a good job.
You can always just blame the algorithm though. Like, just like screw the Facebook algorithm. It's out to get you.
No, but seriously, if I don't get like my metric or whatever the metric of the week is for me, I'll start calling people. Did Facebook just change its algorithm? Like, I'll get really obsessed with this. So, but I've been trying to not, like, I'll literally try to post now and like, well, I'll post, I'll tweet, and then I'll walk away and not get obsessed with it.
That's the classic thing, I guess, like with writers, like the classic insecurity is you're only as good as the last thing that you wrote or whatever. At least that's my sort of insecurity. You can write something that a million people read and then the next day 10 people read it and you feel like, well, you've got the uphill battle again.
Yeah, I agree with that. That's always the case with me. And the thing I try to focus on is two things. One is, if you write top 10 ways to do X, that's always going to get more engagement than even your best possible writing. So the best possible writing is going to be a story like, you know, starts off like, you know, three guys in Jerusalem jumped me and I didn't know if I was going to die or not. So, you know, then you start off with that, you tell the story, then my girlfriend dumped me, blah, blah, blah. She took one look at my mouth wired up and said, we have to end it. And then I'm back in New York with wires all over my mouth and say, blah, blah, blah. Anyway. And so, you know, so those are going to be like great stories that we read, but we don't necessarily share or comment or whatever. But then if you say, you know, top 10 ways to be single in New York with a wired jaw, then, you know, that might get more engagement and more shares. Sure. Like, there you go. That's a great intro biography.
How do you, with your Facebook strategy, how does the brand of James Altucher run? Does it run as a Facebook page, as like business? Does it run as your personal thing? Do you accept friend requests?
I do have a public page, which has done very well, but really my best engagement is always on my personal page. So I just do it on my personal page. And then sometimes I'll repost stuff on my public page, which actually has many more followers, but much less engagement. And so it's really the personal page where, because ultimately, and this is kind of a gray area, but ultimately people are not brands. So you post something on your personal page, not with any agenda like, okay, I'm gonna build, you know, James Altucher as a brand, but I just wanna write something that people that I like are gonna like back, you know, so, and engage with my content. So because I want them, at the end of the day, I want them to like me and the things I do, as opposed to me being a brand and having a strategy. But, you know, one interesting story. So I went over to Ice-T's apartment, you know, the rapper. And so I wanted to just start a sentence like that. So I was hanging out with him and I asked him, just kind of an offbeat question, but I asked him, if you didn't tour or put out an album or appear on Law & Order for 6 straight months and, like, you know, you didn't do anything for six, you know, no, I said it this way, how long would it take for you doing nothing before you think people would stop talking about you? And he instantly responded, meaning he thinks about it. Like, so everybody thinks about it. So Ice-T's been kind of public and in the scene for 30 years, like ever since the movie Breakin' in like 1982. Yeah, remember Ice-T was like doing, you know, rapping? And and he replied instantly, 6 months, which I thought was really strange, because I think actually people would be talking about him for a lot longer than 6 months. But I think we always, you know, underestimate, you know, how long people remember our best stuff. So, you know, people remember his song from like 23 years ago, you know, like 6 a.m., stuff like that, you know, for decades. But people always think, oh, I'm only as good as my last, you know, X article, song, whatever. You know, I had, you know the song Gangster's Paradise by Coolio?
Yeah,
so everybody knows the song. It's the last hit Coolio did. It's in 1995. It's 20 years ago. But people haven't stopped talking about it or him or whatever.
I get excited when he tweets at us. I think he's done that a few times. He's like in tech stuff,
yeah,
now, right?
I went to a like quarterly wrap-up party for an ad tech startup I was doing some freelance work for a few years ago. And Coolio came and judged an ad tech parody rap competition and then rapped for the entire company and was like, there's like several like 50-something-year-old account managers all over him, and he was...
Did he do Gangster's Paradise?
He did. Yeah, but he doesn't really do it anymore. Like,
right, that's the thing. He has another guy who's like right behind him who's rapping, and then he'll go in, you know, put money into power. You know, that whole, he'll do the big lines.
He'll do like, yeah, like 2 out of every 10 words, like he'll do, and then I'll put the mic out to the other dude or the crowd. Yeah. It's very efficient.
Yeah. So I think people underestimate how long it takes for like your best articles to disappear. Like I still see on Twitter people tweeting articles I wrote 3 years ago, and in a weird way that makes me feel bad. Like, oh God, is there anything new, you know, that I've done that's good? Like, is that the only article I've done that's good? But the reality is those are great, you know, you take pride in your great stuff because that will last much longer. Now I enjoy doing my storytelling type articles, but actually those don't last as long or get as much engagement as, you know, the ultimate guide to reinvention or, you know, something that really directly helps people mixed with my storytelling.
So you mentioned like 20 some odd platforms you like to post to besides the big ones we've already discussed, Medium, Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn. Are there any hidden gems that you're really hot on right now?
I like Positively Positive, which you know, has editors but is fairly open. I like Thought Catalog, same thing. So there's a lot of articles that are semi-open. I mean, a lot of platforms that are semi-open. You kind of have to get through the initial gatekeepers. But if you build up an audience on Medium or LinkedIn or other places or Facebook, you can usually, and you pitch content that's good, you can usually get into those platforms. Crack.com is great. I mean, Crack.com, if you have an article on there, it's 1 million views. You know, Vice, Thrillist, Huffington Post, Yahoo Finance, or Yahoo in general. You know, some of these, again, are not 100% open. Huffington Post is fairly open, but not, it's like 90% open, but not 100%.
Bother open or relatively easy to get a byline there if your writing's pretty decent.
Yeah, Vice.com. And they'll let you take the same post you posted. You test it on Facebook, post it on LinkedIn, post it on Medium, and they'll repost that on Vice.
Yeah, yes and no. Some don't necessarily, but the reality... Oh, Quora is another great platform. Great, actually, because then you're specifically answering questions of people that have... And you could see which questions have, you know, 50,000 people waiting for an answer, and though you post an answer on those and, you know, or even retrofit an article you've written to answer that question, and that's great for building up an audience. But and also, Quora is a great platform to practice writing because there's essentially every question is a writing prompt. I think in general, you want to mix it up between like the totally open ones and the ones that are like semi-open.
Awesome. And Quora, do you find, cause I've seen a couple different,
I just want to answer that question. Can you post the same thing? The reality is people who read you on Medium don't read you on Quora. So it's, and don't read you on Facebook. Like we only read so many platforms, so you can post similar things on each platform and no one will say, oh, I just read that on this other platform because they didn't read that other platform. So, you know, they you know, no platform claims to have the whole universe except for maybe Facebook, but Facebook, you only have your universe within Facebook. So it's okay to kind of post other places.
I can see a Venn diagram post going on in Shane's head right now. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that's actually a myth that a lot of people have, and especially I see this in content marketing, where people are afraid to post their stuff that they put on their brand's blog or their personal blog or whatever, because they're like, oh, I'm going to cannibalize my audience. Somehow, someone reading this on Medium means one-to-one they're not going to read on my own site. But that's just not the case. That's not how the internet works.
Right, and I think it's a little, again, to use your earlier phrase, it's like old school thinking, because, you know, if you wrote a book and you published it, you wouldn't think, okay, I'm going to take chapters from this book and put it in my next book, because the books are sitting right next to each other in the bookstore. People will say, oh, I just read this in his other book. So, but now, though, again, people consume content in thousands of ways. So you can post or retrofit in multiple places and no one will know. And I don't say this in a bad way. You want your content to be read by as many people as possible. And they just have different audiences, these different platforms. Like, you know, Huffington Post might be a different platform than MTV.com or whatever. You know,
someone who's a true fan is not going to be like, damn, that James Altucher, I saw him on Facebook and Medium today, right?
Right, and you know, it used to be, you know, so I remember, this is like a long time ago, I was writing briefly for a regional newspaper in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. I went to graduate school in Pittsburgh, and I met the editor, and he gave me a bunch of regional newspapers from like Seattle, Dallas, Chicago, and he said, just read the the headlines in these papers and come up with the same headline and write a story about it here. Because if people are not going to read the Seattle regional free newspaper and the Pittsburgh regional free newspaper. So you can totally take the content from there and put it here. So it's not an unusual strategy, you know, but now it's just more direct. You can actually do this exact same thing, you know.
That's amazing. I did not realize that the modern just copy and paste internet culture had that early of origins and like free weeklies.
I mean, I guess that's sort of the premise of the news wires, right? Like the AP would help, you know, the paper in Kansas get the national story because of that same phenomenon. We're all in different places.
Right, yeah.
All right, so we're about out of having James's time because you got to get uptown for a meeting. Before we go, I'd like to hear one prediction for the future of media from you, putting you on the hot seat.
Yeah, I think people are going to continue to consume media in much more varied ways. And I think almost any way you create content is going to be acceptable. So for instance, you mentioned I'm going up to a meeting uptown. I'm going to do a podcast uptown where I have a guest on, just like you have me on as your guest. Because a lot of people now come up to me, and it's almost a little funny. People say, oh, I love your podcast. And I'm like, oh, great. You know, and I might come in conversation. You read my blog also. And they're like, oh, you have a blog? So people like that. And that's really where I was always writing for like 20 years. And then people now who listen to my podcast might not even know I write. And so people will continue, you know, you kind of have to be a machine. It's like the Phil Spector wall of sound. Like you have to be kind of everywhere and like fill up all the media. Now you're not going to do everything in every medium. Like I don't use YouTube that much. I don't have the face for YouTube, but I have the hair for YouTube. But I don't really use Instagram that much, but I'll use every medium I can to kind of get a message out. Like, so podcasting, you know, Facebook, Twitter. I do a Q&A on Twitter where all the content's 140 characters. Quora, all these places. So just try to be a machine, like this wall of sound approach, because I think individuals are becoming their own brands, and the power of the big brands are only going to be as strong as the individuals that are on it at some point. And then that applies to books too. Everybody thinks they have to write a 60,000 word book, because that used to be like the publisher defined size for a book, 60,000 to 80,000 words. But I think books could be 30 pages. I think books could be a million pages. You know, it doesn't matter anymore because people will be consuming, you know, look at New York City, all the bookstores have died. So, and San Francisco, I don't even think you can find a bookstore anymore. So people are consuming books electronically. You used to need a 60,000 word book to make the cost of printing it worthwhile, but not too expensive for a publisher. So, but that reasoning has gone away. And so now write a book and just publish, write a 10-page book and publish it on Amazon. Now you've written a book. So there's not, their content is fluid now, and the definitions of different types of content are changing, and you have to respect that and experiment with it and indulge in it.
Love it. All right, everyone, we're going to wrap up, but it's been amazing. We got stories about Ice-T and anonymous Wall Street Journal executives, and
we're going to dig into how James ended up at Ice-T's apartment after the podcast. But
I'll have a profile on James coming out on the Content Strategist in the new year, so I'll be sure to get that story and include it. And yeah, for all of James's awesome blog posts, podcasts, and you know, one of the most hottest, most popular newsletters out there, head to jamesaltucher.com. We will make it a destination site after this.
Excellent. Thank you, guys.
And James, it's been so good having you here.
Yeah, thanks for inviting me on.
All right, great. See y'all next time.